for Tuesday, February 12th. I always have to check the paper. 2008. Welcome, members. Welcome, folks who are here today. I'd like to remind people to please turn off all cell phones, Blackberries, and PDAs.
And where's the exit sign?
And the exit signs are
okay. Only
over there.
Seems the Blackberries were taken care of by themselves yesterday.
Thanks. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1067. And Ms. Richardson, if you'd be so kind as to remind us what Senate Bill 1067 is all about, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, let me see if I have some information on that. Senate Bill 1067 exempts outdoor light fixtures from requirement to use only T-type light bulbs in fixtures designated for or designed for metal halide or mercury vapor light bulbs. It removes from the exemption outdoor light fixtures in covered areas used by persons for recreational or educational activities. It extends the deadline for replacing the R-type metal halide or mercury vapor light bulbs with T-type light bulbs to September 1st, 2008. However, it still requires schools to act with reasonable diligence to replace bulbs before that date. It declares an emergency as effective upon passage.
Thank you very much. Mr. Bennett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. The summary that Ms. Richardson gave you, I think, really goes to what the bill is about. The reason is quite simple, and I won't give you any light bulb jokes. There really is no question of the number of anybody that can screw in a light bulb when you don't have the light bulbs, and that's the problem.
It's kind of a zen-like
problem. It is a very zen-like problem. I think the legislature appropriately responded to the problems that have occurred relative to these bulbs and passed a bill that unfortunately we just can't logistically meet the requirements of, which is the replacement of that specific type of light bulb until they're manufactured. We've had substantial testimony on this in the Senate. I apologize that the experts from Philips and other lighting companies, particularly Milstead and Associates, which advises school districts on this issue, were unable to be here today. The bill has moved fairly rapidly. It did come out of the Senate committee and the floor of the Senate unanimously. The other issue, besides the lack of light bulbs, we hope until September, is the outdoor lighting. That issue, upon reflection and discussion, it became clear that the issues involving this particular kind of light bulb really occur inside or in enclosed areas. And we were starting to look at a substantial amount of outdoor lighting having to be replaced. And there then became some confusion over ownership of outdoor lighting fixtures at school districts, who owns them, and in many cases they're owned by power companies who did not believe they're covered by this. As we delved into it deeper, we found that districts were being told essentially it's not our responsibility by the power companies, this bill doesn't cover us or outdoor lighting. And school districts saying, but it covers us and any lighting. And the result was some real confusion. Number two, a huge disparity in the cost of replacing these bulbs. In further discussion, it was found these bulbs, this type of bulb that's under discussion, is reasonably uncommonly used, but of no danger in an outdoor setting. I've worked very closely with my colleagues in the employee unions. OEA and OSEA have told me it'd be fine to represent them in support of the bill. We've worked with OSBA. They're very supportive. We've had no opposition to this. It's a logistical and I think the kind of appropriate use of a special session to resolve some issues that came up in a bill that really had a reason to be passed. And then I guess just finally, Mr. Chairman, I want to really make clear this is not to get around the requirements of this bill. This is important to change these bulbs. Anytime employees face the kind of issues associated with this. We need to be aware of it, and we need to make the changes. We just need time to make the changes. The other change I think is going to be associated with this that makes this bill important is in some cases we're just going to have to change out light fixtures, and this will allow us to go through budget process at the local school district level in order to fund the light fixture exchange process. Some districts won't change bulbs, they'll just go in and change whole light fixture arrays. And I've learned more about this stuff. I won't share it all, but I've learned more about this stuff than I really needed to know. But I am sorry it wasn't shared with you during the session. I wish we'd known as much then as we know now on this issue. So I hope you'll move the bill along. It really is a good bill and really resolves some problems at the local level.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. Any questions, members? There are no questions for you, Mr. Bennett.
Great.
You're off scot-free.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 1067? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1067 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 1067. Can I get a motion from you, sir?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 1067 to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Wisner has moved Senate Bill 1067 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm glad to support this bill, and we obviously made a mistake in the last session in voting this, and I was one of the ones that pushed for the early implementation, but that was part of the fact that we didn't have any data provided to us by department that there was no light bulb. So I hope in the future that maybe it was my fault for not asking or the departments for not telling us we didn't have light bulbs, but we've gone through an exercise here except for adding the outdoor lighting that probably wasn't necessary. But again, I'll take parts of the responsibility and being a member of that committee for not asking the question and ask the Department of Education to try to help us in the future. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair. Any Representative Roblin?
Yeah, and thank you, Mr. Chair. I also felt that moving up was a good idea at the time, so I take some of that partial responsibility. But the other thing I think that is important to note is this is exactly why this kind of session is important. These are the kind of bills when we have done something previously, and to make it go through the whole biennium, it would have put a whole lot of people out of compliance, and it would have caused some other issues that I think speaks well to having been here today and being able to fix this thing, because this is really a minor fix. For those kids who are still in those places, and I hope those schools are using those lights very carefully and checking them well, and I believe that they will do that once they know it. So because of all those kind of things, I think we can be assured that it's going to be checked out quickly. The stories we heard from the accidents led us on this path, and I think it was the correct one, but we're here in a position today to rectify our little errors along the way. Allow things to go. So I appreciate that.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Cobb.
Chair Buckley, I want to declare a potential conflict of interest.
Go right ahead.
Well, since we passed this bill, I have a brother-in-law that is installing these for Salem-Keizer School District. I have a brother that's a custodian, and he told me we screwed up. And a number of other head maintenance people, and so you never know the impact of our actions.
That's good. Good thing to remember. Thank you, Representative.
Chair.
Representative Lim.
I'm sorry, I was just stepped out for a while, but did we discuss the cost of this work yet?
We have not discussed the cost. Would you like that information, Representative?
I think so. If it's cost involved, maybe we should refer to the Ways and Means, or we don't need to.
This is, presumed to be part of the district's ongoing budget. We won't be adding funding for the districts to pay for this to be done.
Okay, that's fine then. I hope this time this is a correct one we passed. And I was one of the representatives we passed this bill, so we are responsible for this bill. I hope this will correct the courses.
Thank you, Representative. And indeed, I'll join in the chorus of responsibility. Though I have just had a revelation the last few days that since we are here in session, we can blame pretty much anybody we want to. So I'm going to decide to blame James Sager for this. He's available. Is there any further discussion on this bill? We have a motion. Why don't we go ahead and call the roll, if you would, please, Matt.
Aye.
Representative Goldman?
Aye.
Representative
Huffman?
Aye. Aye. Ms. Huffman.
Representative Huffman?
Aye.
Aye. The other members are excused. Representative Clem, Representative Greenland. So the motion carries, and Representative Crummell as well. Thank you very much. The motion carries. Would you apologize to the full house on our behalf?
I'd be glad to. Thank you.
Thank you. Nice, Chair. Appreciate that. I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 1067. I'd like to open up an informational hearing on children's vision screening. And we have three witnesses to start off with our information here, Leslie Curran, Julie Bibler, and Carol Robinson. And I didn't know whether you all wanted to come up at once or one at a time, whenever you want to work this fine with us. Representative Kurtek, I'm sorry, did you want to come up and testify? She's busy. did you want to come up on this? Are you here to listen? You're here to learn? Representative Kurtek is here to learn. This is the Education Committee. You've come to the right place. Absolutely. Teaching. Morgan, you'll be up. Do you want to introduce?
Yeah.
That'd be fine. That'd be absolutely fine. Representative Crummell, we have already voted on the light bulb bill. I'll come back to it at the end if you'd like to get a vote recorded on it.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Morgan Allen, Department of Education, and we were asked to come over to give a little background for the committee, and I'm actually going to pass out a copy of the administrative rule related to health services, so I'll do that right now.
I cannot read that, Nigeria.
But just for a little bit of background for the committee, and I have with me Leslie Curran, who's our health services specialist at the Department of Education, a registered nurse and a longtime former school nurse. You can answer the technical questions that I probably am not capable of. So, but just briefly, vision screening in Oregon schools, it's performed in compliance with OAR 581-022-0705, which is being handed out to you right now. And the pertinent section is Section F on the front of the piece of paper coming around. Currently, local school districts are responsible for choosing the method of screening which they use, and they're responsible for designating which grade levels will be screened and who will be in charge of performing that vision screening. Each year, local school districts submit an annual assurance to the department that certifies they're in compliance with this requirement, and we monitor this as it's part of the Division 22 OARs. So, as you know, the Division 22 OARs and ORSs are the policies that the legislature and the state board have said all schools in Oregon and school districts need to meet in order to be considered standard schools. And failure to comply with the Division 22 standards can lead in loss of accreditation, but most importantly, multiple years of failing to be a standard school can lead to loss of withholding of state school fund by the department and superintendent. So with that, Leslie and I are here to answer any questions that may come up. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Carol Robinson, Executive Director of Oregon Health Forum. Chair Buckley and members of the committee, I want to thank you for inviting us to present testimony today to you on the state of vision screening in Oregon. And Oregon Health Forum chose to do a study in the past 6 weeks or so on what is actually happening or what we can determine is happening from district to district and county to county. And so a copy of the testimony that we are going to be delivering is being delivered to you now. The Center for Health and Healthcare in Schools, sponsored by George Washington University, states that vision problems are common among children, with an estimated 13.5 children ages 0 to 17 affected in the United States, and 5.3 million of these, are over 21%, are aged 6 to 11. But many of these problems go undiagnosed. And the real scary thing about undiagnosed and untreated vision problems for school-aged children is that many troubling scenarios can be set into motion. For example, we've heard dramatic examples of children being misidentified as having special needs and learning disabilities and being put into special education programs when the real diagnosis should have been a vision problem. And of course, you know, more commonly known would be significant delays in reading development and other educational achievement. According to the American Academy of Ophthalmology in 2002, 30 states plus the District of Columbia required vision screening in elementary schools or for all school-aged children, while 11 states recommended it and 9 states did not make any mention. Unfortunately, as you heard from Mr. Allen, the Oregon statute OAR 581-022-0705 does require vision screening for Oregon children. And the ODE included school vision screenings during its 2003 update of the School Health Services Manual. But where we were concerned was the nonspecific recommendations of screening, and so the requirement didn't seem to really have any specificity to it, and so that's where we launched our study. So the School Health Services Manual states that vision screening programs should be conducted under the direction of a school nurse and suggests that schools provide screening for children preschool, kindergarten, and grades 1, 2, or 3. It is important to note that at least 2 rural counties in Oregon do not have any school nurse functioning in any capacity, and many school districts have very limited access to nurses who may serve more than one county or school district, while the larger districts, of course, are sharing nurses across many schools. Because of this lack of specificity in the statute, we put out an email and a telephone survey, and we reached school districts in all 36 of the counties. 60 school districts, nearly a third of Oregon school districts, and a total of 117 schools answered our surveys. Of course, we've spoken to the professionals in all capacities, including Alliance International, who does provide a number of services. So attached to this testimony is a copy of the survey that we used to collect the data. And we, because of the wording in the ODE manual, we limited our questions to about students in grades kindergarten through third grade. We know that some screenings are taking place in later grades, but our cursory knowledge in this area leads us to believe that it's spotty at best. We hope to follow up this survey with additional study on older children because so many of the vision problems are identified in the years between 11 and 17. So some of the questions on the survey have not been able to be tallied yet because we don't have adequate information, or the information that is coming back is disjointed. But what we can tell you specifically right now about the screenings that the 60 school districts that we heard from, we asked them what kind of screenings are they being provided. As you heard from Mr. Allen, there is no specificity of what kind of screenings need to be provided. So 53% of the school districts are providing distance-only screening. 23% provide a screening of distance and some other kind of screening, and 23% of the respondents to our survey were unsure of what kind of skills they were screening for. This is important because distance-only screening is not a diagnostic exam and cannot identify the likelihood of other optical disabilities. If children are only receiving distance acuity testing, they are at risk for other common eye problems that would interfere with their education. We also asked who is providing the screening, and we found very mixed results, with the most common approach being a school nurse or a school staff person, frequently the school administrative assistant, working with parent or community volunteers. So you can look at the results on that. Non-medical providers make up 30% of our survey respondents. A nurse actually was providing 10% of the screenings. Lions Club, which is a volunteer organization as well, they utilize volunteers for their screenings, making up 25%. And the Vision Foundation, who you'll hear from, is screening 13% of our respondents. So I think this is really important because the statute reflects a requirement for vision screening to be conducted under the supervision of a school nurse, while clearly this is not happening with consistency. Furthermore, and this I think is very notable, that despite our best efforts in the survey process, it was not possible for us to understand or garner the level of training that the volunteers who are administering the screening tests are receiving. So we don't know if they walk in the room and you know, kind of just, here's your check page, or if they have any kind of at least a five-minute background program.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt you for just a second, if that's okay. Any questions so far? We've covered a lot of ground so far. The microphone's a little bit too close.
Okay. I'll try to back up. Thanks. So I wanted to, I know I'm trying to go fast so that, because I know you are in a tight time frame, but another critical, very critical area of the screening process is the follow-up process when a potential problem has been identified. So most often, a parental notification is sent home with the child indicating a need for further vision testing. But this isn't inconsistent because one-third of the respondents could not identify their school district or school policy to follow up with screening abnormalities. Additionally, a third of our respondents have another staff member and perhaps potentially at that point a trained nurse perform a second screening before notifying the child's parents of a potential vision problem. So that's highly variable. Oregon law states that all students who deviate from the norm in the first screening should be given a second screening within 1 month of the initial screening, and we're not clear whether that's happening consistently. But what we do know is that the results of all screening and testing should be shared with parents and guardians, and our results show that only 40% of the deviances are being reported to parents or guardians, and that is in 60 school districts. In compliance with Oregon state law, when students have failed both the initial screening and a follow-up screening provided by the school, it is stated responsibility of the parent or guardian to secure and fund the vision evaluation. At this time, we only have anecdotal evidence that children are not receiving the visual evaluations and corrective lenses when referred by school screenings, but some of the stories we have been told do indicate a significant gap in this. Partly and largely, it could be explainable by socioeconomics, because the Center for Health and Healthcare in Schools cites that children and families with greater than 200% of the federal poverty level are more likely to have corrective lenses, and those under 200% of the FPL are about 10% less likely to receive corrective lenses. Finally, we asked our respondents to identify if there are sources of additional funding that they are receiving outside of the school district for their screening functions. And we did find that the Lions International is providing 36% of our respondents with additional funding or support. Counties and school districts, 12%, and some grant funding at about 8%. 20% received no additional funding. I'd like to conclude that Oregon Health Forum's vision survey provides preliminary qualitative and quantitative research across the school districts in Oregon. And it indicates that a gap in access to vision care is the result of a disjointed system. It's unclear that the methods of vision screening are providing screenings and how the families are expected to pay for the vision services for their school-aged children. And I've brought Ann Morrell up behind me, who did all of the interviews across the state, and she has quite a bit of anecdotal information if you would like to have that. Additionally, you'll see in lovely colors our results by graph. Thank you, Chair Buckley and committee members, for allowing us to testify today.
Thank you very much. Any questions from that committee?
President Huffman. Thank you, Chair Buckley. Are you at liberty to say who the two counties were that don't have school nurses?
Introduce
yourself, if you would, please.
My name is Ann Morrell. Thank you, Chair Buckley. Can you repeat the question, please?
Are you at liberty to say the two counties that do not have school nurses?
Yes, I am.
And they are?
Chair Buckley. President Huffman, I am at liberty to say that two counties do not have.
Do you know which ones?
I do have that, but I do not have them listed out to protect anonymity during the survey that we conducted, protecting anonymity of all the counties and school districts that we have talked to at this time, considering this is preliminary data research.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please, Representative.
Do you know right offhand, do you recall, was it a funding issue?
I do believe, Representative Huffman, that it was a funding issue and that a lot of times they have to get services from a clinic that is not conducted through the school, and they do rely on funding from them to receive various services, and a lot of times they will be getting some services from the Lions Club Sight and Hearing. And it was unsure of how often that happens and whether or not it's consistent or whether it's on an ad-need basis from teacher referral. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up?
Representative Greenlee.
You have conditions on your survey information, that's clear, but it's certainly public information whether a school district has a nurse available or not, so could I ask
Representative Greenlee, it is Wheeler County was one of the counties that does not have a school nurse.
Wheeler. And the other?
Malheur County, I believe.
Yeah, it is a funding issue. It's going to be worse. It's going to be a little bit. You're going to be some more of them pretty
it's
soon.
It's going to be worse.
Thank you, Representative.
Vice Chair Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Robinson, your study was done in January of 2008, I'm assuming. And what brought that on this committee hearing, or what why did we decide to start looking into this now?
Chair Buckley, Vice Chair Wilson, Oregon Health Forum is a nonprofit organization that provides education, information, and opportunities for public dialogue around health and health policy issues. As part of that mission, we are looking at doing many different kinds of research into different areas, and so we've been asking our members and people involved in the healthcare community areas of interest that they might like to see some research conducted on, and this was brought to our attention that there could be inconsistency in this area. It seemed like a good place for us to put our toe in the research waters, and so we were happy to do that.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Oh.
Mrs. Robinson, did when you you did the interview, did you look at which schools have school-based health clinics and how good they were doing versus non-school-based health clinics?
Chair Buckley, Vice Chair, that's a good question, and we did not include the school-based health clinics into our preliminary research. And the reason why is because, as I understand the development of school-based health clinics, they're happening more at the upper grades. Initially, and so although there are county school-based health clinics that are starting as well, but we felt because we were really interviewing around the elementary and primary grades that we would start at the district level and then at the school nurse or even the school secretary level to get those answers. I don't know of any school-based health clinics that are addressing the needs of primary age children yet, but we would certainly do that with the follow-up study and with the older student study.
One follow-up, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We begin the school years usually, and I see an announcement in the paper that people are playing sports or come in for free physical. So as the eye doctor profession, have they stepped forward? Are they talking about giving a basic screening or anything? Have you looked into that?
Chair Buckley, Vice Chair, that's a great question. And anecdotally, I can speak to something that I learned of today when I was getting physical therapy on my knee this morning. My PT told me that he had been part of a team that Providence Health Systems had teamed with Milwaukee School District for their sports physical program, and so they were screening the incoming freshmen for eye problems as well as part of that, and he as a physical therapist was providing the vision screenings at that, as well as the flexibility and other testing. So I just learned of that today, but that would be an interesting area for high schools to implement this.
But we're still looking for older kids who should be able to relay their vision better than a preschooler, first and second grade.
He did also state that there were three students that were not cleared to play sports, and that he himself did not clear to play sports as part of that screening because of vision problems.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your charts, you have that 53% of the screening was distance-only screening. And I guess the concern, the question is, we then go to the next page, and there's follow-up screenings. Are they only follow-up screens for those people who failed, or are some of the parent notification ones, are some of those, we've still got a problem, we think it's vision, and it may not be distance, but it is something else. Do we know if there's that connection?
Representative Nguyen and Chair Buckley, I believe that the follow-up screenings are done when a student fails a distance exam, and the follow-up screening is usually recommended to the parents if the parents are receiving notification whether or not they need to do some sort of follow-up that there might be a problem. And the second screenings that are referred to in the survey are referring to students that often don't pass the distance exam and are often rescreened at that time by a school nurse where they might identify other problems, and then the parents would be notified after that. Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Vision screening is one thing. And my deep concern is that why do we have more children with a vision problem? And do we have any program that preventing such vision problems in the future? Because in my opinion, nowadays the children, they look at the television and also computers and plus many others, and that causes, you know, draining. The problem. I think we should teach our children how to prevent those things, if possible. When I have children reading, I tell them at least read a book from the 30 centimeter, so if they could. That will continue to improve their vision. But when they try to read close and TV, that will cause more problem in the future. Do we have any programs preventing such things?
Chair Buckley,
it'll certainly help their math, converting 30 centimeters to 12 inches.
Chair Buckley, Representative Lynn. That is not something that we have information on at this time, but I have found that as I've gotten older, I have to hold the paper farther than 30 centimeters not to see it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Good question. My question would be concerning the follow-up process. It's a concern. There doesn't seem to be anything in rule to require the district to do a follow-up process, mm-hmm. though your report seems to say that there is most often a follow-up process, but it doesn't seem to be reaching the mark. Any comments on the follow-up on communicating with parents? That would seem like that would be a very important link to let parents know if their student had failed a vision test and that they would require additional assistance.
Chair Buckley, you may want to defer this question to Mr. Allen, but what we read in the statute, or what was communicated to me through Ann and my conversations about this, was that that if a student fails any kind of screening, whether it be the distance acuity or any additional screenings, that the school is required to rescreen them within 30 days, and then and to send parental notification home. What we had found in our research was that the parental notification was only going home in 40% of the cases. And so, and that may be after the initial screening, and that's something that's really hard for us to determine. And why there may be some consideration by the legislative body, by the legislature, to ask ODE to maybe be more specific within their regulations.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. So no written response? I don't know if you want to respond to that at all.
Sure.
I'll stand here. That's okay.
Again, Morgan Allen, Department of Education. Just a clarification, neither the statute nor the rule require that the screening be carried out or even supervised by a school nurse. We put out a health policy manual that sort of describes best practice, mm-hmm. and that is a recommendation in our health policy manual, but neither the statute doesn't require that or mention that, and neither does the rule. And part of the reason that may be is, you heard some testimony anecdotally that some districts have no or very few school nurses to conduct that, and it may just not be physically or financially possible for some districts to do that. So that may be why it's not included in the rule, or certainly was not included in the statute when it was passed. So,
well, if I could follow up first, Representative, in terms of the parental notification, though, can you tell me, because I don't see it here in the rule, it might be a different place in rules in terms of parental notification.
I'll defer to my expert here.
Chair Buckley, thank you for the question. And the question was, I think I'm paraphrasing this correctly, parental notification, is it required?
Right. Have you identified yourself first, please?
So sorry.
That's okay.
Leslie Curran, School Health Specialist, Oregon Department of Education.
And that was the question. Is parental notification required anywhere in statute or rule?
It is not required in statute. It is a part of best practice in the school health manual, but it is not in statute.
Okay. Thank you very much for that clarification. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Concerns over it, and I appreciate the response. Representative Greenlee.
Yes, I'd like to follow up on something Morgan said. There is a school health manual, and it doesn't require a nurse to do this. Does it provide information on how somebody can be taught to do that exam properly? It isn't all that complicated, but is there a procedure?
Thank you for playing musical chairs. I appreciate that.
Chair Buckley and Representative Greenlee, I think that question was for me. Yes.
Yes.
No. The statute and the health manual do not give a method of testing. That is up to the individual school district and the individual school nurse to determine. There are several screening methods that can be used.
May I follow up,
please?
But we just heard there aren't school nurses in many places.
Sorry. Chair Buckley and Representative Greenlee, every school and every school district does have access to a school nurse. They may not have a full-time school nurse. In fact, they often do not. But they have access either through the ESD. Sometimes they have a contract with a local health department, clinic, hospital, whatever, for nurse services.
Let me follow up
please
once more. Well, I'll see if I can phrase this question differently. Do you follow up to find out whether a school district has, in fact, picked a method and is the proper ability to train people to carry out that method? And do you have any indication whether it has been carried out or not?
Chair Buckley and Representative Greenlee, I do not personally do that. That is something that is done in a different part of ODE through the question process.
Yes, essentially, Chair Buckley and Representative Greenlee, I mean, the district sign off on that as part of their Division 22 compliances, and we don't have resources to go out to the 198 school districts and make sure that they're complying with the vision screening. We trust that when they tell us they're doing it, that they're doing it. And since the statute is somewhat generic, we do put out resources to them with recommendations on how to do it with best practices and best programs. But there is, to my knowledge, no one person or persons at the department that go out individually to districts to check on that.
You send them information on how to do it?
In the health Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlee, the health policy manual with the best practices, so...
Murray, would you be kind enough to supply a copy of that manual to Representative Greenlee?
And also to the documentation the school district signs saying they are complying.
We'd be happy to do that. Both of us.
Thank you so
Thank
much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You've been very patient. Would you like to join the conversation? Please do. We'd love to hear from you.
Representative Buckley, I'm Julie Bibler. I'm from the Children's Vision Foundation, and this is near and dear to my heart. I've been screening children for 7 years, actually a little longer than that, and I've been studying over 19,000 of them in Central and Eastern Oregon, and I have specific information on all those. Know that 15 to 25% of our children out there have vision issues, and many of them don't even know it. If 80% of their learning is done visually, and if that one-fifth, roughly, is having vision problems and nobody even knows it, what are we going to do with those children? 60% of our children that have been connected with learning disabilities actually have vision disabilities, and often undetected. And as I said, I see students day all the time that are failing this screening right here. I notice some of you going, gee, look at this, I can't see this. Try it from right here and know that I see students every day in these elementary schools that can't see those top letters. And they don't even know what they're missing. It's just amazing to me what they are not seeing. So as I said, the Children's Vision Foundation has been screening children in Central and Eastern Oregon for the last 7 years. We're with children in four different counties. And I've got specific information for you on quite a few of those different areas. Let's say they get through elementary level and we start talking about the high school level. I'm not seeing a lot of screenings on that at all, and know that 30% of our high school freshmen can be high school dropouts. So if we look at like the estimated annual cost for a high school dropout for the state is $8,400. If you look at the 70 to 80% of those juvenile delinquent populations out there, we did a 3-year survey over in Deschutes County, and 75% of those students could not pass the screening. That really works in with the national level at 70 to 80%, yes. And 90% of our inmates nationwide have vision issues. So the correlation is we need to be working on finding these students now so that we don't have to be thinking about the remedial things, the way to make them do better later on. Know that 80% of all your high school drop or your inmates are high school dropouts. When we start talking about the 70 and 80 and 90% levels in all these different places, it really starts pointing to a thing that we need to take care of. I will let you know that I heard a couple of years ago that the state of California goes in and they survey their third grade non-readers. And that is the amount of prison beds they plan 15 years down the road.
That's correct.
And Department of Education, Pat Burke, bless his heart, said, yeah, we're doing that here too, Julie. So we're building prison beds for these third grade non-readers. Now, I know we've got a lot of other issues going on with these students, but we need to look at that population that are having the vision concerns and the vision problems and that are telling me, I'm stupid. I always thought that I was stupid. I didn't get it. They got it. Why are they getting it? So I just thought it was something that I was doing wrong. So I got to looking about this, and the current chart that you're seeing back here, there's a history to it. It's called Snellen for a reason. It was created back in the Civil War era by Lieutenant Snellen. They wanted to make sure that the soldiers they sent out could kill somebody or shoot at somebody before they got shot at, and they were having a lot of student or soldiers that were getting shot before they ever got any place. So they decided that we needed to have a standard by which we could check their eyes. Okay. This is a standard that we've been using since 1861. 25%.
Are you still using it?
Yes. And this is our this is our state standard. We're going from an 1861 soldier piece, and we know so much about education now than we did before, and we know that 75% of their work needs to be right in this area, that this only covers basically 25%. So obviously there's a challenge, and we need to be looking at what we can do for it, and we know how to do this. The information is there. Know that as you look at the No Child Left Behind and you look at those revisions, not only is our state looking at this, but there is no piece in the No Child Left Behind revision or anything that is looking at this population. If we don't get that 1 in 5 students identified so that they can get some help, we're not doing our job. Sorry, I mean, it just is that significant. And we've been putting this into the nurses' hands. Well, you notice that there are different counties that don't have nurses. I can tell you I've been to Grant County since 2003. And we've screened all first through fifth graders. It took me 3 days with a group of volunteers. I train the volunteers. We come back in. We rescreen. We do those reports. We talk to the teachers, and we get it back out to them. We went from a 23.5% referral rate in 2003. We do it every other year. We went at this fall in October. We were at a 14.5%. We know there's students that are not ever going to be able to see a effectively, right? They're just born that way, or they've got that way. But we also know that we can significantly deduct that percentage. And that can happen with all sorts of different communities. So I know one of you guys is up there that that's your area, and you've got big packets. This is just information that you can have. You don't need to look at all of it, but I didn't know what part to give it to you.
Did you distribute packets to us?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
Sorry.
All right.
So we're looking at these nurses to take care of this. Our school district nurses are on overload. They're taking care of childhood diabetes. They're taking care of multiple sclerosis. They are taking care of so many different pieces they can't take care of this thing a lot of times. If they're even in our school district, you know that out of the nation, we are ranked 47th in our nation in nurse-to-student ratio, 47th. So part of what we do is we work with the nurses. We work with the FAME coordinators. We work with the parents, the teachers, the administrators, and trying to help them identify those students. I know I'm giving you a lot of information. Let me know if I'm giving you too much.
Well, it's new information, to at least to me, and I'm sure just to other members of the committee as well. Does anyone have any questions up to this point?
Yes,
Representative Lynn.
Thank you very much. So now we know that our children have a 15% to 20% vision problem.
Mm-hmm.
So when you find them, they got the problem, then what's the fix? What do we do? Do we just let them alone? Or do we buy glasses for them or notify parents? So what's the prescription for them?
That's a perfect segment into my next part. What we do is identify. And then by giving that information and educating the population, the teachers, the parents, et cetera, on the need for having that taken care of, then we start the fix. We know that it's the parents' responsibility, but until they know that, they just assume that they're seen in the same way as these students do. They don't know that they're seen any different than anybody else. Now, the New York State Optometric Association screening battery is the one that we, as at the Children's Vision Foundation, use. It screens for distance and near acuity, hyperopia, fusion, depth, near point of convergence, and tracking. Those pieces have been deemed important in getting all four of those different levels to being able for them to see effectively. We've talked about rescreens. Gosh, here's this person. What happens to him after that? The foundation has been rescreening, getting that information back. We'll do a follow-up. The following year, for those second and fourth graders that we refer out, we bring them in as third and fifth graders again, and we check them again to see if they've actually done something. If they haven't, gosh, look at this. We still haven't done anything. What can we do? And I can tell you, I talked to quite a few teachers and principals going, this is a third year that I've seen this. What can we do with this child? So I can only speak to the 14% of those students that were on that survey, but that is what we take care of. Okay? Did that answer your question, sir?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Representative
Kimmel. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, this question is more to the department, if I may, and because I heard you saying, Ms. Bibler, that we're not addressing some of these. Does the department have best practices that they provide to the schools for the teachers to work with students who have vision issues, whether or not the parent takes action? I mean, we can put in state law that the parent has to take action, but if the parent says, heck with you, you know, what's our recourse? Put the parent in jail? And there's a real, you know, that's a real positive thing to do. But I'm wondering, does the department have best practices that you disseminate out to the teachers so that when you identify students that have vision issues?
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, I believe the answer to that question is no. That we don't have any recourse if the parents choose not to take any action to get the vision correction for their student. And I'll let my colleague take a shot at the other half of that question.
Representative Buckley and Representative Crummell, thank you for the question. You know, if a student has a health problem, the parent is the person that it is able to fix that problem. It's not the school. The school doesn't really have the right to step in and solve a health problem for a student. That's a parental right to do that. Course of action to correct a vision problem needs to be set in motion by someone who's a healthcare specialist with some expertise in that area, and that would be who the school would get the direction from. So, for instance, if Susie has an eye problem and needs, you know, think of something, eye exercises or something, the physician or the optometrist or whoever is taking care of that single student would be the one to give the instructions to the school, the teacher, for that single student. That really isn't an educator role to lay out health protocol.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair. I'm not suggesting that it is the job of a teacher to lay out health protocols, mm-hmm. and I would absolutely agree with you that that's not the teacher's role, and they shouldn't be doing that. But there are strategies that a teacher can use in when they're dealing with a student. And just like we have students who, you know, they've got their mouth looks like a trash dump, because of dental caries and that sort of thing, and we make the recommendation that they take, that the parent take, but for because they don't have insurance or because they don't have the money or for whatever reason, you know, whatever the reason is, they don't take the child in to have their teeth fixed. I can see the same thing happening with their eyes. They, well, yeah, okay, Billy can't see squat, and he can't see across the street, but, you know, I don't have the money to take him anywhere and get his eyes checked and get him glasses or whatever, or his dyslexia checked or whatever the case may be. So doesn't the department then have some kind of, I know there's got to be some educational research out there, there's educational research on everything. In terms of what are best practices, is it the best practice to move the child up to the front of the room? Is it the best practice to have them setting off to, you know, so that they're looking at the chalkboard at a 30-degree angle as opposed to a 90-degree angle because of glare? I mean, what are some of the strategies that we look at, has the department developed anything like that that they can disseminate out to teachers so that when a problem is identified that's not being addressed by the students, not asking the teachers to become healthcare providers, but just a strategy that they can to try to help that child learn? Because we have a lot of school districts out there that say every kid learns in our district, and it's not happening. And maybe this is one of those reasons why.
Well, Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, I'll answer that in two ways. The first is I can consult with my colleagues at COSA and OSBA and see what types of policies individual school districts may have in place, because as you've seen from the rule and the statute that begat the rule, it's very vague and, you know, places somewhat of a generic responsibility upon school districts to perform vision screening and a whole host of other screenings. But the second way I respond to your question is that the department does not have staff that have that type of expertise relating to vision problems, and we haven't been charged with that by the legislature. We don't have that expertise. I can go back and talk to some more of the folks in our department that do work on health-related issues and see if that has come up before or districts have asked for that before. But to my knowledge, we don't do anything related to that, what you've described, laying out best practices on how an individual school or teacher would deal with a student who has vision problems, just the same way we don't do that for children who have tooth decay or other nutritional problems or other home problems. We're not set up to do that, I guess would be the way to describe that.
Representative Whitson and I both have recently been appointed to the Education Commissions of the States, and apparently that's a resource that we can use to look into to see if there is any state that has best practice, and I'd be glad to do that.
It's just interesting. It would just be, and if there aren't any states that don't, I mean, maybe that's the case, and maybe this is something that hasn't come up in the past. I don't know that the department may not have, but I would disagree with the state because a lot of our school districts, you know, in dealing with nutritional sorts of issues, are doing that all the time. They're providing breakfast and lunches and dinners for kids so that they do have nutritional food. They're dealing with, there's a lot of other things. I mean, we basically turned our schools into a social service agency instead of being an education agency, which is unfortunate.
Let's hear from Representative Roblin, Representative Wisnett, and I want to make sure we give Julie a chance to finish up, and then Representative Kotek would like to testify on this as well.
Being a person who, as I've said before, is dyslexic and started my eye exams in second grade, had them every year until they found something wrong. The teachers knew all along that there was something wrong in my ability to decode using my vision. But even the optometrist in 1955 had no clue. They just went in, and I took the same test, and I got to go to Seattle from Port Angeles. It was a great day out of school. Got to go to some Mariner baseball games, and actually it was not before the Mariners, but some baseball games. I can't remember the name of the little AA team that we had there in Seattle. So it was a wonderful experience for me to get my eyes checked annually, and it was all because everything that I drew went the opposite direction everybody else's. So no matter what I took off the board, it went the opposite direction, and so the teacher recognized there was a problem but didn't know what to do with it, so sent it off. And taking that to today, we have a lot of teachers at the elementary and at the secondary level who understand more clearly that there are problems with vision that aren't depth and how well you see a distance away. And there are many more professionals out there, optometrists and others. And so, at least at our school district with ours, there were professionals in the business who, when we recognized a problem, we would ask them kindly if they would work with this family and parent. And most of them did that on their own. And the thing that we found fairly clearly was that each student needed something different. There weren't any protocols that worked the same. So the idea of moving up front works pretty well for the distance people. That kind of thing can help. But for the people who have these other auditory who need eye exercises to get their wandering eye to slow down and do some other things, and or the people who have the dyslexic issues or some of these others, that, you know, for me, a blue piece of plastic film over my stuff takes the busyness and my page stops moving all around. And so there's a whole lot of little skills that we have started to get to people. But the biggest issue from my perspective continues to be getting the tools in a teacher's hand to know what they're looking for. You know, so that they recommend that somebody go have the checkup and figure out what's going on. And to don't just think that it's the kid being lazy or that why does he fall asleep every time he reads something, you know, because it is a really difficult task to stay. And there are people who doing that, that's the problem. And so there are methods. But we have to remember that, again, it really isn't the school that can answer that. The professional can. Hopefully, they're getting better. I would say that there's some that know that better than others. But getting them out there to find that person, to find what it happens, and then, when that is found, to make sure that people back in the classroom follow the expectations and work with it, because there's also that kind of problem. So I'm excited we're having this conversation, because I think there are a lot of people who don't. So when you say a vision problem, all they think of is, let's put the glasses on. And I got to get my glasses in middle school, which was really frustrating at the time. But that was only because they checked every single year. I had to go get another eye exam. So I think there are people who knew, and there are a lot of teachers out there. I would hope that we would continue to work in our teacher education programs and all those other kinds of things to help teachers recognize that sometimes the student isn't being stubborn when they're not learning, but that they have another physical problem. And that then it is imperative that the school find avenues to get professionals that can help them. Because we are not going to solve this with school nurses. I absolutely agree. I absolutely agree with what Representative Krummel said, in that if you look at the list of things that have been added to the plate for public schools to take care of since the 1950s, you know, I say that the shock vaccinations in the early 50s, when we started solving the polio problem, when that happened, schools became the place to solve every problem. And so we got out of the teaching business and we got into the help everybody in the world problem. I think that the problem is it's the only institution that does. We still do it better than anybody else, but it's frustrating for teachers and others to get these things piled on them when what they went there to do is try to teach these some subject matter. And so we have to figure this out, because we are loading it up.
I think there's some ideas.
I just get online every once in a while.
Thank you, Mr. Rowley.
Do you have a question?
Yes, sir.
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Julie, thanks for coming over. She's very dedicated. She was trying to say, I don't want to give up my going out and screening kids to come do this. So she worked out a schedule. She actually talked to me about this last session, and I thought it was a... She alerted to me, like I hope she did this committee, that we've got a problem here that we need to address. It appears from quickly looking over your data that you're able to make these screenings at about $5 a kid based upon the limited resources you have. So I think that this is a resource and a way to accomplish what we need to do for our children and the teachers in a most cost-effective way. Mr. Chair, what I would like to do is ask the department to come in to look at this, put together a work group or task force or whatever, and propose some legislation for next session that we could look at improving our statistics and screening, especially the early children, and continue to do that. Because I think, Mr. Allen, I would think that the state that we have in here now is pretty limited, and that it is important to the learning of our children and teachers' ability to teach that we have a better policy or program. And I think that Julie's program with the Vision Foundation seems to be working, and I think if you look at it, like I said, the volunteers she talked about, I'd like to get into more in that, but I don't know that we need to do that in the committee. I would just, like I say, Mr. Chair, my recommendation is that the department look at putting together a group to bring forth some legislation in the next session to address this problem. And I'm sure Mr. Cross and his Oregon Orthopedic Physicians Association would be willing to optometry, eye doctors.
That's better.
Would be able to contribute to that. And because I would like, real quick, just how many volunteers, how do you train them? Your money, your funding is pretty limited.
Actually, I need to get a little bit more into that too at some point in time. This has kind of been, as you said, it's been something that I've seen students, and they are telling me all these different stories, and I see that they can't see well, and I have to do it because I know that they need me to do this. Okay, so it needs to be bigger than this. But this is how we start. If you looked at this paper right here, these are all second and all fourth graders within a six-year time frame in the Ben Lapine.
Wow.
If every one of those has one of these that goes to the schools, so it has a child listed out, what kind of an acuity issue, etc. These are given to the teachers. So you mentioned, okay, does the teacher know that they need to be moved up? Well, yes. We get to the place that they now know, and they're now coming to me. And when I walk into a school, like I will be on Friday, High Lakes has 870 students. It was built for 570. You know, it's going to be really crazy with that. But I have all these nurses, all these teachers coming up going, please, can you check this one? Can you check this one? And so they're getting more educated on that. And they know how, they know now because they start putting names on them, just like Pat Burke did. He was a principal. He said, oh, I have this one, and I know this one, and I know this one. And they had this issue, and I just didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
So yes, we can have a way to do this. Okay? Know that I work out at Youth Challenge. And so the volunteers that are coming on Friday are actually Youth Challenge students that have had this done. Part of their graduation piece is to be doing community service hours. So they get specific training on each of those different components. And then they're working with the younger people right with us and
the Oregon National Guard.
The Oregon National Guard.
Does anyone on the committee know about that?
And they have gone from a 33% referral rate back in 2002 to a 10 to 15% referral rate just because they're now asking their parents or requiring that they have a vision taken care of before they come into the program.
Well.
Not all of them do. Most of them do. We're seeing huge success. But I have to tell you, 18-year-old, big guy that comes up to me saying, thank you, ma'am. I've always wondered. And I'm thinking, high school dropout, at risk, potentially homeless,
18 and always wonder whether he was seeing well or not. It just is something when they did that.
I think you made a very strong impression, I think, on this committee, and I'd be very grateful if Representative Wisner would put together a work group and request help from many of the members of the committee looking towards a proposal for 2009. And again, your foundation it sounds like the approach is quite innovative and something we should see if we can spread out further. Thank you all very much. I'd like to invite Representative Kotek up to testify on this. Thank you all very much. Thanks for being here.
Mr. Chair,
yes, Mr. Chair.
I just want to put in the record that the SI read this screening, mm-hmm. that the Alliance, they contributed 25%.
They did, yes.
And 37%. I think we should put the record.
Yes. Thank you very much. Lions Club, great organization. And Mr. Robinson, thank you for coming, too. There was a concern out in the hall about the use of a coffee as a weapon, and I'm just hoping that in the future you don't feel like you need to defend yourself on the way into the hearing room.
Thank you, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. For the record, Tina Kotek, State Representative, North Portland. And just wanted to be very brief, particularly to, I think some of the long-term solutions are dealing with our school nursing issue here in the state. And just want to remind folks, because we did pass a lot of bills last session, but there is a task force now underway that has, they had their first meeting back in the fall. They've started to meet, looking at what can we do around improving school nursing services throughout the state. We do know we have gaps. They're trying to do some surveying to figure out where those gaps are, come up with recommendations for the next session, maybe for two or three biennia out of how we can improve, get ourselves up off the 47th ranking here in the country in terms of what we do around school nursing services. It's, I think, the longer-term system issue around making sure that kids have access to schoolhouse services, vision screening being one of them. But I think we can certainly do more. I think Representative Wisnant's suggestion around a discussion, a work group or something, we could definitely have a statewide campaign. And I think there's a lot of private interests. Obviously, you have the Lions, you have the foundations like Julie's, and there are a lot of people out there willing to help. I do think there's a longer-term issue around having that school staffing, either at the ESD level or at the school district level. But in the meantime, I think there's something we can do here, and I'm really appreciative of the report you heard today. It's really very good information. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions?
Representative Kremlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More of a comment. One of the things, you know, we always need to look at, you know, sort of out of the box kind of thinking, and okay, how are some innovative ways that we can do this? And one of the things that we tried to do a number of years ago and met with some blockage from a variety of different people, so maybe you guys can take a run at it, and that is using as one of the rotations that the student nurses at OHSU and Linfield and our other schools of nursing around the state go through, is to have them go into a school and be the school nurse under the supervision of a district RN or somebody in the community, but this is one way that in the smaller communities where, I mean, they're lucky to have a building to put the kids in to teach them and that sort of thing, and having, you know, core teachers, much less having any kind of ancillary staff. So having you know, a student nurse, that's part of their training, maybe is an option to look at.
Last comment?
Yes, very briefly. Representative Kotek, thank you for being here. Thank you for your patience. You've been involved in the Medicaid Advisory Committee, involved in the whole question of health care children. There are 82,000 children in the Medicaid program. Do we have any certainty that those kids get proper visual screening as a part of their health care?
Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlee, that's an excellent question. I don't know we've ever talked about the vision screening. You know, we do look for preventative well visits for children who are covered by the Oregon Health Plan, but it would be something maybe we could possibly have the department run and find out how many are getting the vision screenings. And, of course, you know, we do have a bill on over in the House Health Care Committee to make sure that more children at very low incomes who are on the health plan actually stay on by maintaining 12-month continuous enrollment, because once they get identified, we have to make sure they have ability to get corrective lenses or whatever. So I will check into that. I don't know the answer to that question.
Thank you. And we take care of it next door.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your we'll quick close it off.
Okay. I will give you an offer. I know that I have communities all over, from Medford and Ashland area, clear up to Madras, from Prineville to Mill City Gates, and Adana, and that Mill City Gates Adana, that's only one, that's one school. You can take care of that whole north corridor with a group of volunteers in about 3 days. And we could do some task force pieces. If you have some school districts that you're, or some schools that you're wondering what's going on, why don't we see if they can see? It wouldn't be that big of a deal. If we could get a few, some funding on that and get the volunteers set up, we can start taking care of those students really fast. So it's just an offer. Think about it.
No, I think we all heard it. Very good. That'll be part of the work group's discussion. I'm going to go ahead and thank you so much. Thank you very much for coming up to testify. I'm going to close the informational hearing on children's vision screening. I'm going to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 1067, and I would entertain a motion.
Yes, Mr. Chair. I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow me to be recorded as voting aye on...
Could you move for both you and Representative
Cromwell?
He was absent, late too.
Yeah, I was late too. You're willing to do that? If not, I can do it myself.
I request unanimous consent that the rules be suspended to allow Representative Cromwell and Representative Greenwich to be recorded voting. Should I put in the aye at this point? No, it's recorded voting on the motion to approve Senate Bill 1067.
Thank you. Representative Greenwich has moved the rules be suspended.
We will not change the outcome.
In order to allow Representative Greenwich and Representative Cromwell to vote on Senate Bill 1067, will that change the outcome? Is there any objection to the motion?
How can I try and decide?
Hearing no objection, so move. Representative Greenwich, what's your vote?
I vote aye.
Thank you. Representative Cromwell, what's your vote?
Aye.
The motion still carries, and Representative Whistle will still be the carrier. Thank you very much. I close that work session. Members, we do not meet tomorrow, or we meet tomorrow evening.
That's right.
As a reminder, tomorrow evening at 6:30.
You're bringing dinner?
Hair Room F. There's sandwiches in the lounge, in the fridge. With the Workforce Economic Development Committee at 6:30 tomorrow night. Until then, we're adjourned. Thank you very much.
See you tomorrow.